Before we get into today's episode, I want to let you know about a source of powerful free resources to help you as a parent or grandparent get equipped to invest in the faith of the next generation. Our Next Gen website has been designed to help empower you to navigate tough issues with the young people in your life. At Next Gen, you'll find articles, entertainment reviews from a Christian perspective, parenting stories, helpful parenting guides, and even answers to the tough questions. All these resources are free as you engage on the front line of raising the next generation for Jesus. So why not register today at premierinsight.org/resources to receive free resources from NextGen. That's premierinsight.org/resources. And now it's time for today's podcast.
We're discovering that actually biology matters. We can't wish it away. We can't wipe it away with a magic wand or with some crazy technology. That people really do care which mother carried them to term.
What kind of society do we want to build for the future? What kind of world do we want to create for our children to be born into? These are vital questions for everybody. I think that as Christians we do have something very specific and actually amazingly relevant to contribute to this important debate.
You're listening to Unbelievable with Justin Brierley.
Hello and welcome back to the show. Reproductive technology and the surrogacy industry is what we're talking about today with John and Tim Wyatt. And John will be part of our lineup for Unbelievable the Conference 2022 on Saturday, the 14th of May. Have you booked your place yet? We just released a video this past week with a taste of what's coming up as we come live from the British Library in London for our special theme, God Unmuted. Unbelievable.live is the place to check out all of the details, the guests and the ticketing options as well. You can also watch the video promo for the conference there. Loads of response to our Ukraine special from last week. I'll bring you some of that later, along with feedback to other recent shows. And just a heads up that you will hear various references to Ukraine in today's show, but this show was recorded shortly before war broke out, so some of the references will be out of date. And of course, the surrogacy in Ukraine is in as much turmoil as the rest of the country right now. But with that caveat aside, here's today's programme. I'm excited about today's show. We're dealing with an ethical issue. Ukraine's surrogacy industry is sort of the hook on which we're talking about today's ethical issues around reproduction. The ethics of paying for pregnancy, essentially. John and Tim Wyatt are joining me. Well, Ukraine has been obviously very much in our news in recent weeks as tensions with Russia have escalated. Less well known is the fact that Ukraine is a major destination for so-called reproductive tourism. Their surrogacy policies allow women to earn significant amounts of money compared to the average wage by carrying foreigners' babies as surrogate mothers. Well, today my guests Tim and John Wyatt are here because they're starting a new podcast, or they're launching their current podcast on the Premier Unbelievable network. It's called Matters of Life and Death. I'm really excited about this new show that's joining our network. John Wyatt is a doctor and bioethicist who frequently writes and lectures on the intersection of Christianity and medical ethics. In fact, John will be one of our speakers at this year's Unbelievable conference on the 14th of May. And he sits down on the podcast to talk with his son, Tim, who's a journalist, to look at current events in the world of technology, biology, medicine, all from a theological and ethical perspective. So today we're going to be joined by both John and Tim to talk through the ethics of surrogacy at home and abroad. Ukraine is by no means the only country that's seeing a boom in surrogate mothers. Plus, we may get to other ethical dilemmas that exist in terms of infertility, IVF, the increasing trend towards genetic modification in reproduction and so on. But first of all, let's introduce John and Tim. Perhaps we'll start with yourself, John. Welcome along to the show. Tell us a little bit of your background. You have a long and distinguished career, both as a doctor, as a bioethicist. Tell us about some of the highlights along the way, if you would, John.
Yeah, thanks. No, it's great to be here, Justin. And I, as you say, my background is as a medic. I came to London initially, it's nearly 50 years ago, would you believe, and started training as a doctor at St. Thomas's Hospital here in central London. and then did a number of different things, but increasingly was attracted towards the world of paediatrics. I loved kids and went into that field, and then ended up as a specialist in caring for newborn babies. And the technical term is a neonatologist. I worked in a big intensive care unit here in central London, where I had the privilege of caring for many, many babies, some of them incredibly tiny. And it's really through that work that I realised I was in the midst of an ethical maelstrom. There were all kinds of new ethical challenges coming up as technology was advancing, and we were in a very cutting-edge area of medicine. It was raising all kinds of questions. You know, was it always right to resuscitate every baby, try and keep them alive? Is it ever right to switch off the life support machinery? And what about reproductive technology and test tube babies and advances in genetics and issues about abortion? So that, because of all these issues, I increasingly felt that these were things I had to tackle, particularly from a Christian perspective.
Yeah, great stuff. Well, we'll come back to you in just a moment to talk a bit more about the new podcast, Matters of Life and Death. Tim, you are the host or co-host of this podcast. Tell us a bit about your background as well. Obviously, you are the son of John. That's the first thing to mention.
Indeed.
But how, where does your own interest in these sorts of issues stem from?
Yeah, well, I had the good fortune or misfortune, depending on how you see it, of being talked through some of these issues that Dad was bringing home from the hospital around the dinner table as I grew up, which I guess was the kind of sowed the seeds of a fascination with not just medicine, but kind of how Christianity intersects with public life and social issues. And so I'm not a scientific person. I'm more of a words person. So I ended up going down the road of becoming a journalist after a while, I found myself working for a newspaper covering the church, and so started becoming very interested in the church and in faith. And for the last 4 or 5 years, I've been freelance, and my kind of specialism is again that intersection between religion and social life. So it's a lot about kind of what's going on in the church and other faith groups, but also about issues that people of faith are fascinated or concerned about, whether that's homelessness or divorce or assisted suicide. And I really am passionate about trying to speak both to people of faith and to those without faith in different publications about how to better understand what values is driving people and dig into some of these things that are of greatest concern, I guess, in life. Mm.
Yeah. Well, thank you very much. And thank you for the podcast, which I think was really a lockdown project, as so many things have been in the last couple of years. Tell us what gave you the impetus to start the Matters of Life and Death podcast.
It was a lockdown project. We started the show back in 2020, just a few weeks after COVID had pinned us all down in our homes. It was really John has been working for many years. He writes books and gives talks and kind of has developed a whole kind of suite of resources about trying to apply his medical knowledge to help Christians think through ethical issues. And what we thought was a podcast is a great platform to get that information or to that conversation out to younger people of my generation who maybe are less likely to turn up on a windy Wednesday evening, maybe at a church hall, to hear from Dad. And so it was really wanted to have a conversation, an intergenerational conversation between John as the expert, the ethicist, the professor, me kind of asking the stupid questions that the audience might want asked, and to really have almost an interflow of ideas across the generations to hopefully prize open some of these issues, some of these questions that people might have.
And I think you, John, have really appreciated, because of lockdown, because of the need to go online, get on Zoom calls, you know, so much of what you would normally do now happening in the digital sphere. It's kind of opened your eyes a little bit to the fact that actually this work can reach a very broad audience, actually, because of, you know, what lockdown has taught us in the process.
Yeah, absolutely. It's blown me away how good the technology is. And it's opened up for me lots and lots of possibilities, particularly across the world of engaging with doctors and with other people around the world. And I've really enjoyed working with Tim. And again, his background in news and current affairs and journalism it's a really important perspective to try to communicate the technical stuff that I deal with in a way that really engages and makes sense with where people are today.
Yes, that's great. Well, I'm really pleased that we're bringing the Matters of Life and Death podcast into the Premier Unbelievable network of shows. I think it'll really help in terms of fleshing out some of these ethical issues that are so important in the current age, and Christians and non-Christians to think through some of the implications of where technology is taking us, and how we make sure that it doesn't dominate us, that we are still in control, if you like, and so on. Tell us about some of the issues you covered so far and plan to cover. Maybe, Tim, you start off with some of the issues that you have covered so far in the podcast.
Yeah, well, funnily enough, although it was a lockdown project, we hadn't really intended it to be a kind of COVID podcast, but we found that we were launching a podcast about ethics, technology and healthcare in the middle of a global pandemic, and it seemed wrong to do anything else. So for the first few episodes, we dug into a whole heap of issues around COVID. We looked at how Christians have coped through periods of plague in the past, and what that might teach us today in the present about how we can live distinctively. We looked, of course, loads around the vaccines. We discussed some of the concerns that Christians and others had around the vaccines. We talked about the ethics of compelling people to take a vaccine or not, the different technologies that are lying behind the vaccines. We talked about lockdowns, about different ways of controlling the virus and limitations on freedom, and how we might think about the ethics of that. But we've also moved away from COVID, so we've also tackled things as varied as, we did a kind of retrospective about John Stott, who was a close personal friend of my dad, and went 100 years after he was born, who would have been 100 years old. We talked about Christian leadership and some of the issues and the legacy of his ministry. We've also done, artificial intelligence and robotics, all kinds. I've lost track.
I've listened with great interest since getting hold of it, and I just so enjoy the interplay between you. I think it's actually really fun having a father and son kind of dynamic going on in the podcast, because you're kind of there, and you can't offend John or you know.
Well, it's particularly when we're talking about fertility, like, you know, and here is the product of my and my wife's fertility, you know, arguing back. I mean, it's ridiculous.
Exactly. Yeah, no, it gets a bit meta at times in that way. Anyway, I'm again just really pleased that we've been able to bring Matters of Life and Death to the Premier Unbelievable network of podcasts. There is a link from today's show if you want to check it out for yourself, start listening. Do highly recommend it. You get the archive of shows that have already gone out, but there's some really exciting stuff in the pipeline as well as we begin a new season. So today, though, I thought, why don't we talk through a significant issue that we haven't really covered on this show in the last few years at all, really, and that is the ethics around reproduction. Specifically, as I mentioned in my intro, you know, there's some really interesting stuff going on around the world in terms of the surrogacy, what I've termed industry, because it feels a bit like that in certain parts of the world. Before we kind of look at the specific situation in Ukraine, what are the laws in the UK and in other countries at the moment, John, around this issue of surrogacy, and what does it actually involve specifically when it comes to other women carrying another couple's baby?
Yeah, so it all comes under the heading of reproductive technology. And really that starts way back in the late 70s. 1978 was when the first test tube baby was born here in the UK. And what the development of reproductive technology meant was that you were able to get access to different parts of the reproductive process. So you could isolate sperm and eggs, you could create an embryo in the laboratory, and then you could take the embryo and put it back into another person's womb. And so all these kind of different permutations and combinations start to become possible through the technology. And surrogacy is just one of the possibilities that reproductive technology opens up. But the idea of surrogacy is that either an individual or a couple who are desperate to have a baby, but who for whatever reason are unable to do it by the normal means, they can create in the lab using a sperm and an egg, they can create an embryo, and then that embryo can be transferred literally across the world and implanted into the womb of another woman. She carries the baby all the way through until the baby's born the normal way, but at birth that baby is then taken away from the carrying mother and is given back to what I often call the commissioning parents, the ones who actually organise the process. And in the UK, this has been recognised for a long time, but the rules, the law is very strict, because the law says that it's legally the carrying mother is the legal mother of the child. However the embryo was created, the woman who delivers the baby is the legal mother of the child, and she cannot be forced or compelled to give away the baby, even if money has changed hands. And the other thing the law says is that you cannot have a legal commercial arrangement. All you are allowed to do is to provide reasonable expenses for the carrying mother. So surrogacy does happen, but it happens more as a kind of voluntary arrangement. Mm. And sometimes it's like a family member. It might be the sister of the original couple or something like that, who agrees to undergo this surrogacy arrangement. But because of the very strict law in the UK, many couples look outside the UK for the possibility of undergoing an arrangement.
And to that extent, just at the biological level, the child normally that the woman is carrying isn't biologically related in that sense to her. It's normally a situation in which it's two other parents who are, as it were, the biological parents of that child.
Yes, so that's the difference between surrogacy and the normal kind of IVF. In normal IVF, the commonest kind of IVF, people would the egg and the sperm are created by a couple, and then the embryo is implanted back in the womb of the person who donated the egg. But it is possible to have other combinations. So you can have embryo donation, whereby another couple donate the embryo to a woman, she carries the baby and then looks after the baby once the baby's born. So it's fascinating, really, how there are many, many different options. Of course, what surrogacy has become then particularly relevant for same-sex couples, both male and female same-sex couples who wish to have a child. And particularly for male same-sex couples, this is really the only way that a male same-sex couple could have a baby who is genetically related to one of the males. And this is now become relatively common, that two men would agree together, they would create an embryo, getting an egg from somewhere else, they would then transfer the embryo into the womb of a surrogate mother, and then they would say, this is our child.
Yeah. So, I have heard of this, and you know, there are various sort of names given to it. You've used the term reproductive tourism. I've heard of the term wombs for rent. Tell us, Tim, what are you seeing internationally in terms of the places where there is more liberal approach to surrogacy, places such as Ukraine?
Mm. Well, as you mentioned at the start, there's been a lot of focus at the moment on Ukraine, obviously because of the situation there with Russia about to already invading. Ukraine has become one of the kind of leading centres in Europe of this surrogacy industry, as we could call it. Unlike in the UK and in most Western European countries, it's not illegal to do it as a for-profit arrangement, which means that there are now a number of agencies which kind of advertise their services in the West. And so there's a number of, particularly Irish for some reason, couples who have commissioned a woman in Ukraine to carry their child for them, due to give birth or about have just given birth, and they're unable to get into to Ukraine to collect their child and bring them home because of the imminent conflict. But it's not just Ukraine; it's not unheard of in other former kind of Soviet bloc countries in the Eastern Europe, but also globally, places like India, lots of other places in Southeast Asia. Unfortunately, this really points to something that makes me slightly uncomfortable about it, which is that it almost exclusively tends to be richer Western people hiring, effectively hiring out the wombs of women from the majority world in tends to be living in poorer countries, because the sums of money here are extraordinary. You know, if your Irish couple are paying maybe 25,000-30,000 euros for the service, the agency takes an enormous cut, more than 50% of it, but that still means 10,000 euros for a woman in Ukraine, where I think the average annual salary is only a few thousand euros, is an astronomical sum. So you can see there's real financial benefit there, but also real risk for exploitation.
Absolutely. I mean, John, where do you land on all of this? I mean, you can understand why, with the technology available and if the law allows it, people would go down this route, because infertility, I can imagine, for many couples is just the worst thing they can face, and there's a huge desire to have a child and so on. So you can understand the motive. Where do your concerns lie, as it were, in the way that this is now developing?
Well, absolutely. So from a Christian point of view, I do think that's where you have to start. You have to start with the pain of infertility and to recognize and empathize with the fact, the desperate desire that couples have to have a child. And I think that infertility is often not recognized as such, including by Christians. And I think Christian churches can be incredibly insensitive towards their own members, some of whom are struggling to have children. You know, so often churches these days are very family orientated. There's a great emphasis on the children's service and celebrating when a new baby's born and Mother's Day and all that kind of stuff. And yet the statistics show that one in seven couples on average will be unable to have a baby without technological help. And so, you know, there are many, many couples who struggle with this. So I think we start there and say, yes, this is a very real pain. And I therefore don't want to just say, well, reproductive technology is wrong and it's evil and it should never be considered. And indeed, you know, I've had private conversations with a whole number of couples who've agonized about, you know, what would be the ethical issues about going down this kind of route. But my own feeling is that if for a husband and wife who are married to generate an embryo in the womb and in the lab and then to insert it back into the woman's womb so that she can have a baby, that seems to me like an appropriate use of reproductive technology. It's something that you can defend. It's sort of restoring the masterpiece, to use an analogy. Whereas surrogacy seems to me to go into a really different kind of territory, which carries within itself all kinds of complications. You know, what happens when the mother doesn't want to give the baby back? What happens if it turns out that the baby has some disability? Have there been cases where a baby's been born with Down syndrome and then the initial couple have refused to take the baby back, and then, you know, what happens if the mother has some very severe illness during pregnancy? She might even die as a result of the complications of the pregnancy. So there are many, many possibilities of things going horribly wrong. And also there's the question of identity. You know, who does this child, how does the child understand who they are? Now, of course, these kind of identity problems are very common in our world anyway, but it does seem as though the technology is adding to the complications. And then finally, I would want to say, you know, as we've already said, there's this kind of power imbalance. And what we see so often is that technology accentuates the power imbalances in our world. So it's the rich and it's the powerful, it's the strong who are effectively dominating and even abusing those who are weak and vulnerable. And technology, paradoxically, you would hope that technology had the effects of balancing everything out, that whereas paradoxically it often seems it works in exactly the opposite direction.
Yeah, and I guess that's the great danger is also that as much as you can see the attraction for a woman in Ukraine to potentially, as it were, offer herself in this way, there is potentially an abuse going on at the same time, Tim, when it comes to essentially people who are more rich, more powerful, effectively treating these women as a, for something that feels like it should be sacred almost, it almost feels like it becomes a commodification almost of a woman's body in this way. And I guess you would have a concern as a Christian just on that front.
Absolutely right. I think it tells a slight lie or a comforting untruth, which is that women and their wombs can be separated, but a womb, for it to be able to carry a child to term, is not just a standalone vessel that you can just hire from another person. It is intimately connected and is an intrinsic part of the holistic whole of that human being. And so, you know, even if both parties, both the commissioning mother and the carrying mother, believe that this is a simple commercial arrangement, the reality is, I understand, I'm told, and the evidence supports this when they've done studies, is that spending 9 months nurturing a life inside you, even if you know and intend to give that child to someone else, like, that has an effect on you, that you are now forever a one of the mothers of that child. And I think splitting, we talked about this before, John, about the procreative and the unitive bond. And in Christian theology, the kind of God's ideal is that the procreation of children takes part within the unity of a marriage. And therefore, the act of sex is not just simply about building intimacy or simply about procreation, but it's somehow mysteriously both at the same time. And all of these surrogacy, and to some extent other forms of reproductive technology, they are separating out God's design. Now, I understand that, and I agree with John, that not all forms of technology are would be wrong for Christians to pursue, absolutely not. But I do think we need to think really carefully about what is the... People are not means, they're ends in themselves, and that's true both of the child. Are we treating the future potential child as a means to satisfy something within ourselves as a couple? Mm. But also the surrogate mother, she's not simply a womb for hire, she's a whole, complete human person. And, yeah, I just have real worries about what impact it has upon us and upon our humanity, yeah, upon the image of God in us, to go through this kind of process.
I suppose it... You know, there are so many different ways in which these things can occur as well. And I'm sure different people will have different relationships with the birth mother and so on. As you said, John, it might be a family member. And in a sense, they become a sort of, you know, aunt who carried you to term or something. But equally, it may be that it's more of a commercial arrangement and that person is never part of their life again. And that may leave the child with questions later on, I suppose, about, well, maybe I did want to know who. And I can imagine that's even more acute probably in the case where you might have, especially in the instance where gay couples are wanting to bring children into the world in this way, there might be another egg. You know, it's only one of the men who's or one of the women who's, if it, like, genetic DNA is part of that child. Now, in that instance, that raises a whole nother question of, well, does a child have a right to know who their biological parents are, or is it okay for, you know, the parents of this child to say, well, actually, no, we decided to do it this way? I mean, this is a whole nother huge topic, John, but any thoughts before we go to the break?
Yeah, it absolutely is. And I think there's a fascinating book I read some years ago, which is just called Who Am I? And it just tells the stories of a whole number of adults who were conceived through different forms of reproductive technology, particularly sperm or egg donation. And they described the way they had come into the world had been hidden from them by the people who they thought were their parents. It had all been concealed. It was a matter of shame. And then gradually they become aware of the fact that they don't seem to be genetically related to the person they thought was their father or their mother. And then they go on this quest. And then sometimes, you know, they discover they have 20 or 50 half siblings. But what came out of the book quite strongly was that many of these adults said, one, I'm extremely happy to be alive. I'm very grateful for the fact that I have my life. But two, I don't think the people who brought me into existence were thinking about me at all. They were simply thinking about their own need to have a baby. And they weren't thinking about how that person they were bringing into the world would actually think about themselves, what their own identity would be. And to that extent, they were being selfish.
We're going to come back to this in just a moment's time. There's so many more issues I want to dig out in this whole area of reproductive ethics and surrogacy and so on. But today on the show, I'm joined by John Wyatt and Tim Wyatt. They are hosts of the Matters of Life and Death podcast, which has just joined the Premier Unbelievable suite of podcasts. So you can find the link to it and get more great discussions between them both from the podcast. But we'll be back in just a moment's time. ¶¶
listening to Unbelievable with Justin Brierley.
Welcome back to today's show. I'm joined by John Wyatt and Tim Wyatt. They are the father and son hosts of the Matters of Life and Death podcast. You can find a link to the podcast from today's show. But we've been talking on the show today about issues around surrogacy, reproductive technology, what's sometimes called the reproductive tourism. And we were hearing about the case in Ukraine, which obviously there's a lot of tensions, and that's only served to really further complexify the situation for surrogate mothers in Ukraine and the couples who are waiting for babies in other parts of the world. I know that back in when lockdown struck, there was an interesting article in The Guardian that you sent me, John, in which it talked about the industry around this that exists in Ukraine. But as you said, I think it occurs in many other countries as well. But we did get onto the subject of what happens not just in the surrogacy situation, where there may well be, you know, at least the biological, you know, parents are both involved in the baby that is produced. But there's also, you know, many other instances where there may not be a biological connection on the part of one parent, especially, you know, as you increasingly gay couples are wanting to have children, but there can only be one sort of partner, as it were, represented genetically there. So what kind of complexities is that bringing into the lives of children, into just the legal aspect, I suppose, as well, of parenting and that kind of thing, John?
Yeah, well, this is another good example of how, as technology advances, it raises all kinds of unforeseen questions. And just going back briefly to Ukraine is an interesting country because in terms of technology, reproductive technology, it's actually very advanced. It's got some of the best high quality, you know, anything that you could have in the West would be available in Ukraine in some of those major centres, but it has a much more lax regulatory framework. And there are many countries around the world where that's the case. You have extremely advanced technology, but with a much more underdeveloped legal and ethical framework. In fact, I can remember I was travelling in Southeast Asia and talked to the dean of a medical school there, and we were talking about ethics and so on, and he said, you know, we've got all your Western hardware, but we don't have your software. And that's exactly what he meant. He said the whole ethical tradition and legal tradition which we've developed over the centuries here, and what's happening around the world is the technology can be transplanted. Now, if you've got a few million dollars, you can create completely from fresh a cutting-edge reproductive technology lab, and hire the specialists and so on. But the question is how you use this technology. And certainly here in the UK, we've been wrestling with this for 50 years nearly, and interesting dilemmas about what you put on the birth certificate. The birth certificate becomes a very important legal document, and what's been decided is that, for instance, in the case of two men, a same-sex couple who use surrogacy to have a baby, that they can apply to have the two men names go on the birth certificate as two, quotes, parents. And the law says in that case that no person shall be the mother of the child. In other words, the law defines that, says there is no mother. As far as the law is concerned, there are two parents and they're both men. Mm. So it's a fascinating kind of understanding, yeah, of parenthood, that parenthood is ultimately a kind of social construct. It's lost its connection with the basic biology.
I would assume, though, even in that what sounds to me quite extreme case, there would need to be some biological record of the mother, just from the point of view of if there were heritable diseases, you would want to know, and so on. So is there a sort of difference between the legal side and maybe what is in the child's medical records, where you would want to obviously have some information about the mother?
Well, actually, that's a huge problem, because the way that the HFEA Act is framed in the UK is that it would be a criminal offence for confidential medical information to be released against the wishes of the parents. Mm. So it's entirely up to the parents. If the parents don't wish anyone to know who the literal biological mother of this child is, then even the medics can be locked out of that information. And as you say, that potentially has enormous implications about if a genetic disorder becomes apparent and so on. So there's a tension here. On the one hand, the law is trying to protect confidentiality and trying to prevent stigmatization of a child who's being conceived in this very unusual way. On the other hand, there are, you can't avoid the biology, implications of the biology.
I mean, Tim, it's got almost overtones as well of the current debate going on around transgender as well, where, you know, people want to have the ability to change their gender on a birth certificate and so on if they feel it doesn't represent who they are and so on. But that has all sorts of legal and medical implications for what you then do if you can't, you know, tell, you know, and so on. So yeah, any thoughts on sort of the quandaries that this brings us into?
I was going to say, what really fascinates me is that it's mirroring, but almost in reverse, a discussion which has happened in the world of adoption. So in some ways, adoption was almost like a pre-medical form of reproductive technology when couples, you know, going on for thousands of years, when couples who can't have children would adopt another couple's child. And historically, it was done in the same way, you know, that they would be a new birth certificate would be drawn up with the adoptive family on there. And most couples chose not to tell that child. It was a big secret, and we tried to almost wish away and pretend in some sense that this child was biologically theirs. But actually, there's been decades of research which has flipped it on its head, and the contemporary adoption kind of best practice is the total reverse. And so rather than erasing the kind of biological reality, which is what we've been trying to say with, you know, these rewriting birth certificates or you know, using surrogates, there's actually the best practice in adoption is now to actually raise the child always knowing that they have a biological mother and a father elsewhere, and in some cases where it's safe to do so, they even have ongoing kind of relationship and contact with that child, and so it's not about erasing and denying the reality and trying to wish away what has actually happened. It's about the evidence is that children, even if they are adopted at an incredibly young age and have no memory of their birth family, when they reach a certain age, it's quite common, if not more common than not, for that child to want to have some kind of relationship with their biological family. And we're discovering that actually biology matters. We can't wish it away. We can't wipe it away with a magic wand or with some crazy technologies, that people really do care which mother carried them to term and what time and day they were born and, you know, where they come from, who their people are, what their kin is. That is hard baked into us to care about that and identity. Even if you're really happy with your adoptive family or your commissioning family, I suspect many, many children will want to know something about the surrogate mother who carried them.
And to that extent, do you feel the same policy should be adopted then, you know, as currently exists in adoption, that the best route is to have that, whether it be adoption or IVF or surrogacy, donor sperm and so on?
I have to say, I think I probably do. I think it's a complex issue and I need to reflect on it a bit more. But I think if I was a child that was conceived through some form of reproductive technology, I think I would want to know. And I think I might even say, I think I have a right to know. A child is not the possession of their parents. They grow into becoming their own independent, autonomous human being. And I think it is probably the child's story to know. And I'm uncomfortable with the idea that basic facts about how they came to be and where they come from can be obscured or obfuscated in some way.
So it's interesting how the regulatory authorities have struggled with these kind of issues. And the compromises occurred in the UK is that once you get to 18, you are able to approach the HFEA and ask for information about your origins, but there's no legal or duty on your parents to tell you in advance. And there was an anxiety amongst the planners and the regulators that it would be possible that I would fall in love with this other person who was actually genetically related to me through the same donor and not know that. And in fact, there have been this bizarre cases where people find a romantic or sexual attraction to this stranger who turns out to have an unknown genetic relationship. So in order to get around this problem, what the HFEA advises you is that before you decide to pair up with somebody, and particularly before you decide to have a baby with them, you should contact the HFEA and ask them whether or not you're genetically related to this person with whom you are planning to have a baby. And they will look into their records and will then tell you either yes or no. This is an appropriate relationship or no, this is not an appropriate relationship.
But that would be contingent on you even being told in the first place that you were conceived in such a way. And are you saying there isn't any legal obligation on the parents to do that? Or should they do that when they reach 18? Is that
no, there's no legal obligation. Right. And in fact, all the evidence is that the vast majority of parents don't, or at least a significant.
Right.
So it would be perfectly possible that all of us, unknown to us, well, probably not me because it didn't exist when I was when I was being conceived, but possibly you, unknown to you, you were conceived through donor gametes, and your parents concealed it from you.
And of course, the parents often tell themselves, not untruthfully, that they're doing this to protect the child, because the child will be devastated to discover that actually they're genetically unrelated or only half related to their parents. But I think, again, there's actually been lots of studies done about adoptive children who are in the same boat. And actually, the evidence is that while it is a painful realization, in the long run, it is often healthier for a child to not live in secrecy and to grow up knowing that they come from a complicated background, but at least they understand what that background is.
Well, I mean, as you've said, Tim, you know, in days gone by, before these technologies were available, adoption would have been the natural course for many parents who do experience infertility. So is this now competing with that? Is it causing any issues with the numbers of children that are being adopted in your experience? What's the situation when it comes to adoption?
Yeah, it's a good question, Justin, because it actually has changed the adoption landscape quite significantly. So historically, if you look at this is talking about the UK, where I'm most familiar with, there was the majority of children kind of in the system available for adoptive parents would be very young babies, largely born to unmarried women. And it was kind of culturally and socially unacceptable for single women to raise a child. And as such, therefore, most adoptions were kind of young babies without any kind of significant background of social services input. And that has completely changed. Primarily because of the legalization of abortion, it has to be said, and that many of these children, the pregnancies are no longer carried to term, but also because socially it's more acceptable for young women to have babies outside of wedlock. And so now, adoption, as you say, is the children in the system are 99%+. They're not young children who've been relinquished voluntarily by a mother. Mm. They're children who've been forcibly removed by social services. But as you say, it's also now competing. Adoption is just one of the slate of options. And my understanding is when you kind of go through the infertility diagnosis, this is not from personal experience, but I understand that you are generally steered towards medical options because you're being told by a doctor. And so I know, and I kind of worry is a strong word, but I fear that actually adoption, which is for many couples can be a really positive and affirming, redemptive solution to infertility, is just something they're not being offered or not thinking about because there is now this dizzying array of, frankly, more financially lucrative options for the medical professionals to push you towards.
Yeah, I'm afraid that's, you know, I think there's a lot of elements of truth in that. And one of the things which, again, we just have to acknowledge is that reproductive technology is extraordinarily commercially productive. You know, that fertility specialists are some of the best paid doctors in the world. It's not unusual for them to be grossing enormous sums. And so there is a very strong commercial aspect here. And there's also a kind of commodification or consumerism, you know, which I, as a paediatrician, were often sensitive to, this idea that parents want to have a baby who's a perfect baby, who they've got in their mind's eye, you know, here we are as a couple, but we don't have this baby. And if only we could have this baby, you know, this perfect baby, that was part of us. This would just make our life complete, and this would just be wonderful. And so the baby is really almost like a product. And then when you suggest adoption, oh yeah, but that would be somebody else's baby, and you know they might have some problems, and I'm not sure they would fit in, and it would be much better for us to start again and create our own baby. And there's a really I think a sad aspect, really, but the as a paediatrician, you know, we need to see each person as unique and valuable in their own right. And when you think there are so many thousands of unwanted children in the care system, just in the UK as well as across the world, that then to be using very sophisticated technology to create another child because they are genetically related to me does create concerns for me.
And to potentially, obviously, has these knock-on effects of creating a sort of potentially ethically questionable systems by which children are, you know, are brought into being through countries where there are these more lax sort of regulations and the potential abuses that
can and this is incur. Definitely a recurring theme that we start with a human problem. Yes, it's an ancient human problem. I mean, infertility, difficulty in having children goes back, you know, you can find it in the Bible, can't you? All these cases of where infertility is very much part of the narrative. But what's new is now we're going to use cutting-edge technology to solve this ancient human problem. But what we're not so aware of is all these new complexities and problems and power imbalances which the technology brings in. It isn't just a neutral kind of intervention. It carries with it a whole lot of other challenges, questions, and often the price we pay. It's like the technologists are saying, you know, you want a baby, we'll give you a baby, but it will cost you. And what that cost is often not more just an economic cost. It's a whole human and ethical cost as well.
Yeah, I mean, I almost wonder, Tim, whether, as John said, the consumerism aspect of this, without wanting to judge the pain, you know, that couples go through, and I can fully understand why this would be such a, you know, an option on the table for so many people. But at the same time, is it taking us towards this idea that a child is somehow a right rather than a gift, in a sense, and that there will be situations, as there always have been historically, where people are not in a position to have their own child? And again, you know, that's why adoption has been, you know, in a sense, you'll find adoption throughout the Bible as well, won't you? So it's given almost a very, you know, we are, you know, Christians talk about being adopted as sons and daughters of God. It's almost a divine thing in Scripture. So I guess it's that whole question of, you know, are we going down the line of seeing simply children as a right rather than a gift in that sense, Tim?
Yeah, I couldn't agree more. I was going to say, I mean, there's a real theological angle here that we need to discuss as well, which is that this longing for a child that is of my DNA, we might have used in biblical language, from my blood, in my bloodline, is a deep, deep longing. And as you say, we need to be really careful here, because I don't want to cast aspersions on couples, Christian couples, who feel that pain. I know people in that situation. Mm. It is incredibly painful. It's a real wound, and we see it throughout, as you say, throughout Scripture. This is an ancient wound. But I think there is an important transition from Old to New Testament that we need to reckon with as Christians, which is that with the coming of Christ and the kind of bringing of this new family of God, the gospel pivots away from bloodlines and says, actually, in the kingdom of God, there is a different understanding of family. And we have that because we call each other brothers and sisters when we share no DNA. And I think that's also true inside families, that that's what's powerful about adoption, as you say, is it mirrors what has happened with us, our spiritual adoption. We've been grafted into the family of God. But also it mirrors something about the church. And that's true for couples who don't have children, whether through adoption or any means, they can still be part of family. In the world, we say family is determined by who you're related to biologically. But in the church, we say you could have brothers, sisters, aunts, uncles, mothers, fathers who have no connection to you by blood, by DNA, by any technology, but they are significant spiritual family. And I think it's really important that Christians don't fall into the trap of believing the world's conception of family, which is all driven by DNA, by blood, and that drives people to spend these enormous amounts socially and financially, and actually say, whether through adoption or just simply through being grafted into the family of God in a church environment, you can find real spiritual, meaningful, eternal family through a different means.
Yeah. I think that's fantastic. Mm. I totally agree. And I think theologically it's helpful to see that the bloodline, as you put it, is really talking about creation, isn't it? It's having children. It's what creation gives us, this ability of making love and making babies. And what the reproductive technology is doing is sort of grafting onto creation. It's taking the ability of a sperm and an egg and a womb. It's all about creation. But as you say in the New Testament, the emphasis shifts. It doesn't nullify creation, but the emphasis shifts towards grace. And so adoption, when we adopt a child who desperately needs a family, the primary motivation is not about, you know, I'm creating a child for myself, but I am showing grace, showing compassion, love to a child who desperately needs a family. Mm. And it's important not to confuse those two things. Creation and grace are not the same thing.
Yeah. I mean, John, how would you then counsel, perhaps, let's say, a Christian couple specifically, who have reached a point where they've realised that they can't conceive naturally and are looking at the options on the table here? And it could be a sperm donor or an egg donor. It could be their own sperm and egg, but with a surrogate mother. Or it could be adoption. It could be IVF. You know, there are a number of different possibilities that depending on the circumstance. Where would you begin with a couple who are in that position, John?
Yeah, well, and as we said at the beginning, I think the first place to begin is to empathise with the pain and not just to leap towards the solution, but to recognise the pain and the fact that, sadly, you know, many of us struggle with painful realities which we didn't choose. But this is, that biology... I often think that, you know, as modern people, we're control freaks. We control so many aspects of our life. And it's like biology is the last frontier that we're not able to control. And it's almost like, you know, our creator, Almighty God, holds back biology and says, you're not the boss. You don't control your life. You cannot make it happen. And so I think to start by empathizing the pain, and then I would quite gently sort of just explore, have you thought about, you know, do you need to think in advance what the implications will be? You know, have you thought about what the implications would be about going for IVF? You know, the so-called normal kind of IVF, which is where you take the egg and the sperm together, it still can have enormous psychological consequences. I mean, it's, you know, because in our, when you're making love with your partner and your spouse, it's like you're at the most intimate and vulnerable part of your relationship. And yet what happens when the IVF is, it's like you're in the bedroom with your partner and all of a sudden the lights come on and all these people with white coats come marching into the bedroom and say, okay, well, I need a sperm sample from here and we need to check the cervical mucus here and then you need to have an injection here. And this most intimate and vulnerable part of our relationship is now suddenly being exposed in what can be quite a invasive and painful way. So thinking through the psychological consequences, thinking through what would happen if something went wrong, have you thought about how you would feel? You know, you're going to have to live with this decision for the rest of your life. Have you thought about what you would say to the child and what the implications would be? There's something called using natural fertility technology. Actually, there's quite a lot of evidence that rather than go straight to the technology, if we try to actually encourage the natural process, try to understand why this couple are infertile, and there has been evidence around the world, and studies have shown that in some cases, just concentrating on the natural, on enhancing natural fertility can be quite successful. But I certainly would raise the possibility of adoption and of asking people to really think, what is my motivation? What is driving me? And would it be possible that we could offer hospitality to a child who desperately needs a family?
There's another ethical concern that a lot of Christians I know who are in this position wrestle with when it comes to IVF, which is the so-called problem of the surplus embryos. Because as the system works, as far as I understand it, the doctors kind of prompt super ovulation to produce multiple eggs, sometimes as many as 25 or 30 eggs, rather than just the one egg you would normally produce in your menstrual cycle. They're then harvested and you don't you only re-implant one or two after you fertilize them in the test tube in the lab, and And therefore, you have the question of what do you do with the 25 or more kind of fertilized embryos that are just in cold storage in hiatus? And some couples will keep them back and attempt a subsequent cycle of IVF with them. But in many cases, they would be donated for embryo research, and the law says after 14 days they must be destroyed. Or they sit there on ice for 10 years, and there's a time limit again, I think, where after them they have to be destroyed. And obviously, many Christians would believe that life begins at conception. These aren't just 8-cell embryos. These are human beings. And so there's a real ethical dilemma about, is there a way of doing IVF that doesn't involve superovulation, and where we don't have these kind of leftover children lying around in cold storage.
Yes, I remember going into work years ago on the underground, in the old underground, as it was, everybody was reading newspapers, so you could read the headlines of the newspaper, someone sitting opposite you, and I was staring at this headline, and I kept staring at this headline. In the end, I had to go, after I got off the underground, I had to go and buy the newspaper to see what the story was, because then it said, "I still love my frozen babies," and I kept staring, "I still love my frozen wow. babies," and it turned out it was a story about embryos that were, there'd been a rupture between the couple. One said they wanted them to be destroyed. The other one said, "No, I still love my frozen babies."
Yeah, well, these are the sort of the way that technology produces unique problems that we never, in a sense, had to face before. But for understandable reasons, when you have the technology, it's so tempting to use it to fulfill what is often the most central desire in someone's life. We'll just have another 5 or 10 minutes on the other side of a break and remind people about the new podcast as well, where you can get far more in-depth conversations about all these issues. I know you've covered IVF, surrogacy, and all kinds of other issues as well around reproduction, but also beginning end-of-life issues, technology, transhumanism, everything else. I'll again remind people of how to get hold of the Matters of Life and Death podcast. But we're talking today about reproductive ethics. My guests are John and Tim Wyatt.
You're listening to Unbelievable with Justin Brierley.
Welcome back to this week's edition of Unbelievable with me, Justin Brierley. John Tyson is coming up later on The Profile at 8 p.m. tonight. The influential New York pastor and author will be the guest of Emma Fowles. He's also featured in the latest edition of Premier Christianity magazine. And you can, of course, find The Profile as a podcast wherever you get your podcasts from. Coming up next week on Unbelievable, best-selling Christian author Philip Yancey recently sat down with me for a live Q&A with hundreds of Unbelievable listeners. Next week we'll be playing that out. Find out his thoughts on faith, doubt, the crisis in Ukraine, and the future of the US church. It's a show where he really opens up about his own journey with God too, and the grace he's seen in his own life. So you can hear that and see that on our video channel next week. That's our Ask Philip Yancey Anything broadcast next time. By the way, our next live event, of course, that you can book in for is on Saturday the 14th of May, the Unbelievable Conference. You can find out more details at unbelievable.live. Really looking forward to our lineup for this year. Includes Lisa Fields, who's the founder of the Jude 3 Project, an apologetics and outreach ministry with a strong emphasis on equipping those of African descent in the United States and abroad. She's passionate about helping racially diverse urban communities to contend for the faith. So really looking forward to having her there. A real international flavour to this year's conference, with Joseph D'Souza also joining us from the Good Shepherd Church in India. We heard from Joseph just a couple of weeks ago on the show. Founder and international president of the Dignity Freedom Network, an intercaste and interracial alliance. So there's going to be all kinds of issues covered, but it's really about helping Christians speak with grace and truth in our present cultural moment. So if you'd like more, do go to unbelievable.live to find out more about the conference. It'd be great to have you with us. You can attend in person or online from anywhere in the world. We're doing it at a time that's really friendly as well for listeners in the US to join us too. Stick around for some feedback towards the end of today's show. Right now, let's get back into today's programme. Well, it's been a really interesting discussion today on surrogacy, paying for pregnancy, lots of other issues as well around reproductive technology. I'm aware Tim, as we finish up today, it's not just Christians who listen to the Unbelievable Show, but plenty of non-Christians as well, who many of whom may have, you know, experienced infertility, gone down some of the routes we've been talking about. And maybe for them, they don't necessarily see that there's a sort of divine issue here, that aspect of the moral question doesn't particularly factor for them. But so is, I mean, if ultimately, let's say, just as a thought experiment, we are ultimately sort of material in origin, that we, you know, and yes, a clump of cells in the early stages is just a clump of cells, perhaps. I mean, does that make this kind of conversation irrelevant to someone who doesn't share the faith of a Christian when it comes to issues around the way we bring children into the world and parenting? And
I don't think it does, actually, Justin. I think regardless of what you think happens kind of before conception or what the status of that clump of cells is, what is undeniable is that clump of cells, if in the right conditions, will grow into being a person. And that person, like we talked about before, they're not simply a kind of disembodied sense of self, but yourself is encoded into your physicality, is into your flesh. Those 2, 4, 8, 16 cells became millions and billions of cells, and they are who you are. And as I said, all the evidence is that people don't. We can wish away some of the brokenness of our physicality, but conceive children through various eccentric and exciting technological means. But fundamentally, those children grow up to become adults, and they have the same kind of concerns about their materiality, where they come from. And so I think these are really important questions for anyone from any kind of set of any faith or none to ask, is what does it feel like for the child who is conceived via surrogacy or embryo donation or IVF and sperm donation? What questions will they have about who they are and where they come from when they get older? And I think it's important to say that, you know, I personally, I'm not kind of condemning or damning all reproductive technology as the wrong thing to do. But I think there are some really, really critical questions we need to ask ourselves, not just about what would it mean for me, but what would it mean for that child when they are 18, 25, 30, 35. Ask questions about who they are and where they come from, because ultimately that's what this is for. People aren't means to an end. Children aren't a way to fulfill ourselves. They are ends in themselves, and therefore their needs, their feelings, their identity, their sense of self must be paramount in our decision making.
And I suppose, John, it so much of this comes down to that age old question that obviously applies to Christians as well as non-Christians, of, well, you may have the technology to do something, but should you use it to do something?
And what's fascinating to me is that, you know, these are age old questions about what it means to be human, you know, what's the purpose of existence, what are the relationships between parents and children, inheritance, all those kind of things. What's fascinating to me is that as the technology advances, it raises those age-old questions, but with a new take. And I find that it's not just people of faith or people who are Christians or come from a religious tradition. It's often many people want to engage with these questions because they recognize that these are really important, these fundamental questions about what it means to be human, and also what kind of society do we want to build for the future, what kind of world we want to create for our children to be born into. These are vital questions for everybody. And yes, I think that as Christians we do have something very specific and actually amazingly relevant to contribute to this important debate.
Tell us what you're looking forward to doing as you go forward in this new endeavor, the Matters of Life and Death podcast. I'm so thrilled again that we're bringing this into the sort of the orbit of the Premier Unbelievable Network. But tell us what your hopes are, I suppose, for those listening as you unpack these kinds of issues. And this is just one of a whole range of issues that you have talked about and will continue to talk about. Maybe Tim, start us off on what your hopes are for this new podcast.
I mean, it's exciting, really, because we've already been kind of preparing some of our first episodes when we kind of relaunch on the Premier Network, and we're going to be looking at this whole question of control and technology and its intersection with humanity. So we're looking at human enhancement and transhumanism, and so, you know, research into trying to extend human life beyond 100, 120, 150 years. things about, you know, could we implant tiny kind of machines into our brains to change how our thinking works? As you say, these come back to such fundamental questions about personhood, and these are questions of interest to everyone. So yeah, I'm really excited about, I really enjoy these conversations because I get to learn a lot from my dad, who's obviously an expert and has done loads of research. But I think it also fleshes out, we go from the particular issue and we flesh out to thinking, hopefully helping Christians think through who might be encountering these in their lives, how to address them, but also hopefully to sharpen broader thoughts. Like we had that conversation about bloodline and theology and the new covenant. Hopefully these kind of specific social issues sharpen our thinking more broadly about how we read scripture, but also, even if you're not a Christian, how you think about kind of life, the universe and everything.
Yeah. And John, I know that you've not only obviously done the podcasting, but you've written many books along these lines as well. One of your most recent was actually on the whole area of robotics, wasn't it? Do you want to just tell us about that quickly?
Yeah, I was part of a project investigating the implications of robotics and AI, and particularly thinking from a religious and Christian perspective. And there's a book that's come out from that called The Robot Will See You Now, which is available. And I'm currently trying to write another a book on the topic of AI, and these issues I think are incredibly important. You know, the speed of transformation, the work that's going on, and interestingly, the pandemic has actually accelerated a lot of this stuff. It's focused more attention on the online world, on technology, on AI, and I think over the next few years we're going to see a whole new lots of new things being rolled out, and it's vitally important that we think about this from a Christian point of view. So I'm really excited about this potential, very grateful for the support from Premier to be part of your suite of podcasts, and really looking forward to the adventure of what's to come.
Well, there's a link to the podcast from today's show. Do go and subscribe to it. I can promise you, since I've subscribed, I've just found them so interesting, the conversations between Tim and John, and we're going to be bringing you many more in the future. Also, so glad, John, that you're part of our speaker lineup for the Unbelievable Conference, coming live from the British Library in London on Saturday, the 14th of May, and for what you'll be able to bring to us as we learn how to speak with grace and truth into these ever-increasing complex situations that we're presented with, but how we can do that with the Spirit of Christ within us. But thank you very much both for being with me on today's show.
Great.
Thank you.
Thanks, Justin.
Look forward to hearing what you made of today's show. Do send me your thoughts in. The usual ways apply. You can email unbelievable@premier.org.uk. You can tweet me @unbelievablejb. That's my personal Twitter channel. You can also find the show page at facebook.com/premierunbelievable. Over on Facebook, there are other ways to get in touch as well. But you can find all of that and more from our show page at premierchristianradio.com/unbelievable. Glad to say that you can also now start downloading Matters of Life and Death to go and get hold of the podcast wherever you're listening to your podcasts from, and be interested to hear your thoughts on some of their recent shows between John and Tim. Of course, our thoughts have again been turned in the direction of Ukraine for the whole of the past week, and continuing to hear such tragic stories, but also some really emotional moments as well. I don't know if you've seen the video of Ukrainians reading Psalm 31, for instance, from bomb shelters, but it's a very, very powerful video if you haven't seen it yet. And thanks to all those who've been getting in touch about the Ukraine special we did last week with Father Cyril Hoveron and Clifford Longley on the roots of this war, Putin's Holy War, as we dubbed it. Just a couple of responses, and we'll save some more up for next week. Paula on Twitter said, "Putin believes in nothing, but he does understand how he can use religion and nationalism for his own purposes." Another person said, "If the Orthodox and Catholic were united as they had been for 1,000 years, then things could have been very different, as historically Western world has been greatly influenced by the Catholic Church. Also in the West, evangelical churches sprang up from the Catholic Church. And Bryony said, I watched the Unbelievable Ukraine special. It was fascinating, if troubling, as ever. So good to have people like Father Cyril, who have a real insider feel of Russia, Putin, the Church, Ukraine, etc., and to get an alternative and very compelling narrative apart from the prevailing NATO/democracy one. Thanks also to Nicholas Sagovsky, who helped us to find, actually, some of the guests for this show, who said, congratulations, Justin, on such an excellent program. It did just what I hoped it would do. It provided sensitive, careful, thoughtful information and discussion in a truly awful situation. It illuminated why Christians find themselves fighting Christians in Putin's war. I thought the approach was just right, asking the questions that would be in the listeners' minds with real thought for what this is costing Father Cyril and so many other Ukrainians. Hope it leads to some good feedback and discussions. Yes, indeed, and there has been lots of feedback. And if you want to add yours again, you can do that the usual ways, unbelievable@premier.org.uk, or feel to drop in on our social media too. And I've got some bits and pieces from the mailbag that go back a little way. I thought I'd do a little bit of a clear out of some of the comments that have come in over various weeks. Steve wanted to say, over the last couple of years, I've run into many atheists and agnostics and former Christians who have bought into the theory of the evolution of morality, the idea that there doesn't need to be an absolute moral code given to us, but instead, morality is a science that has evolved through generations of humanity. This theory has been frustrating to respond to, partly because there are hardly any Christian apologists and pastors responding to it. Seems we're still stuck responding to classical atheist arguments around morality, while in the US, and I can't speak for anywhere else in the West, we're becoming more secular and more moral at the same time. Christians doing good in their community receives a shrug in my context from non-Christians with the idea of, well, aren't we all supposed to be doing good anyway? Why is that special? The idea that Christianity contributed to the moral leanings of the West is not only being utterly rejected, but the science of moral evolution is being used to scientifically support this fact so that it can't be argued with. I would love to see a couple of episodes from both Unbelievable and Ask NT Write Anything addressing this. I know that the author and psychologist Jonathan Haidt has been mentioned as supporting the theory of evolutionary morality. Perhaps he could be a guest. On the Christian side, the only apologist I've really found who has addressed this issue head-on is Greg Kuchel. I'd also love to hear Bishop Wright's robust response to this theory. Thanks, Steve, for getting in touch. It's an interesting one. I think, though, there are more than you've perhaps given credit for, Christian apologists responding to that, because in a sense, whatever theory of an evolutionary form of morality that you may come up with, you still have to grapple with the question of whether that morality is objective or not, or simply a subjective thing that, you know, could have taken a different course if evolution had taken a different path and so on. And that for me still leads back to the God question. And obviously that's been done by many people. But I could highly recommend people like Nick Spencer, whose book The Evolution of the West clearly lays out the way in which Christianity has contributed to, you know, modern Western views of democracy. Obviously, as has been often mentioned on this show, Tom Holland's book Dominion does a similar job. Theo Hobson's book God Made Humanism is another good one on that front. There's various other people dealing with that. Glenn Scrivener has an excellent new book out called The Air We Breathe. I think it's in pre-release at the moment. Glenn's going to be joining us at Unbelievable the conference, though, and I'm sure we'll be speaking on this subject. He's really done a great job. I think it's kind of he's kind of compressed that huge volume by Tom Holland into a much sort of smaller book that's really accessible and just lays out the way in which Christianity has shaped all our moral instincts in the West. It's a remarkably good book. So looking forward to getting Glenn both at the conference and I'm sure on the show to talk about that in due course. Great to hear from you. Thanks for some of those thoughts. Roland says, I've listened to all the arguments for the existence of a God, and I'm still wondering if there are, one, deductive arguments that conclude directly to the Christian God, two, deductive arguments that conclude from the existence of a God to the Christian God, and three, any other arguments that put forward the truth of Christianity that are not centered around Jesus and his resurrection. Number four, philosophical arguments to show that other religions are not true or other gods don't exist, for example, the God of Islam. And number five, philosophical arguments for monotheism or against polytheism or pantheism. Do you have any shows about this issue, those issues? Do you know any books that talk about arguments for the Christian God and not just some God? That's from Roland. in Vienna. Roland, well, so many shows which have dealt with various aspects of your questions there. And if there are any listeners who want to suggest further resources, please let me know and I'll forward them on to Roland. But I mean, deductive arguments that conclude directly to the Christian God, I suppose arguably you might get that from something like the ontological argument is perhaps close to being a deductive argument. But by their nature, most arguments, philosophical arguments for God, are arguments from inference, I would say, to a large degree. But other arguments that put forward the truth of Christianity that aren't centered around Jesus and his resurrection, well, it would be hard to find an argument that didn't involve Jesus for the truth of Christianity, given, you know, the clue is in the name. So I'm not sure what kind of arguments you'd be looking for that didn't center around Jesus for the truth of Christianity. Possibly that you could, I suppose, ones that kind of look at the Old Testament prophecies for Jesus. But again, that would be prophecies that Christians believe relate to his resurrection as well. So anyway, any ideas for Roland in Vienna, let me know. And let's go to some of your response to recent editions of the show. We put out a classic replay recently, Stephen Law and Glenn Peoples, when they debated the evil God hypothesis on the show. And Steve said, I greatly appreciated that show. Look forward to your program each week. After listening to the program, as well as the previous debate between Craig and Law, I've been thinking deeply about moral arguments for God's existence. One of them I've constructed looks like the following. Always love it when people send in their own thoughts and arguments here. Okay, number one, humans have a moral sense, and on this basis we conclude that humans embody a mixture of good and evil. Number two, by this moral sense, good is better and superior to evil. So if a supreme being exists that is indeed supreme to humans, he must be supremely good if he is indeed supreme. Third, by way of the cosmological argument, the fine-tuning argument, and the contingency argument, we have reason to believe such a supreme being exists. Number four, therefore, that supreme being is indeed good. Now, one could object that our moral sensibilities are merely evolutionary adaptations and illusory, but the burden of proof will be on the skeptic to show that these are merely evolutionary and not real. Another objection could be that a supreme being only need to be supreme in power and not in morality. Well, this calls into question whether good is actually better than evil, but it seems that the power of the deity is somewhat a separate concept from the moral character of the deity, and so we should not confuse power for virtue. Those are my takeaways. Keep up the good work. Thanks, Steve, out in Colorado Springs. Yes, I think what your argument sort of boils down to arguably is a sort of a bit of the moral argument for God, a bit of the sort of ontological argument that if a supreme being exists they will be a maximally great being, and that would include moral virtue, and then, you know, bringing in other arguments for the existence simply of a creator and putting them together. And in a way, yes, that's I think the way a lot of people would do it. They would say there's lots of different bits of evidence, you know, you put them all together, you have a cumulative case for the God that looks a lot like the God of Christianity in the end, not just a sort of a deist sort of, you know, creator who set things in motion. Thanks for getting in touch. Also, this one from Johannes, in touch about the show we did, that fascinating show on Dylan, Lennon and God, between John Stewart and Steve Turner, who said, I greatly enjoyed today's discussion on the spiritual journeys of Bob Dylan and John Lennon. However, I was a bit disappointed when towards the end of the discussion, the role of LSD came up, and it was suggested that LSD-induced experiences are just brain chemistry. Well, so what? The same could be said about near-death experiences, out-of-body experiences, or unusual states of consciousness entered through intense meditation or prayer. In each of those cases, the experience is correlated by certain significant changes at the level of the brain, as shown through fMRI imaging. However, this does not diminish the subjective meaningfulness of the experience, nor its tremendous transformative potential. I can't say whether the encounter with something that distinctly feels like an alien mind during an ayahuasca journey is just neurons firing, or whether it's related to anything outside of it. But again, the same is true of NDEs, OBEs. And while atheists typically point to the evidence that NDEs are also just brain chemistry, and therefore the experience is somehow devoid of value, here we have ex-Christians who seem to think that a psychedelic experience is meaningless because it, again, is just brain chemistry. Well, why? I'd say that by their fruits ye shall know them. and the fruits are quite impressive. Both near-death experiences and magic mushrooms have a similar effect of greatly reducing the fear of death, the latter demonstrated again and again in clinical trials. Both give you a deeply meaningful experience, an experience of unity, something that is bigger than your small conventional self, and both are often deeply life-changing. In my view, this is what counts, and now whether the underlying substrate is just brain chemistry or something else in addition, consciousness is deeply mysterious, and the fact that we can observe certain processes in an fMRI scanner does not in any way explain the mystery away. Since the dawn of human culture, humans have always used techniques and substances to enter other planes of existence. In traditional cultures, they have been deeply embedded in religious and spiritual practices. So I would urge caution against devaluing and belittling such experiences, and I would humbly propose this as a topic for a future show. Well, Johannes, in a way, it's been a topic of a previous show, and if you haven't come across it, do go back and check the really interesting discussion on psychedelics and that kind of thing between Ashley Lander and Peter Sherstad Hughes I think it was in September, October last year. And Send Proof, that was another show we did back in January. Really interesting debate on miracles. Elijah Stevens, Michael Shermer and Craig Keener joined me. Dave Wave on Twitter sounds a skeptical note on the issue of miracles, saying 7.8 billion people in the world, up to 2.6 billion tagged as Christians, 7.3 billion smartphones, and one story of an internal organ increasing in size. Skeptical face, says Dave Wave. Okay, thanks. Someone else, though, says, personally, I think I've had 5 instances of the supernatural occur in my life. On top of that, my brother used to be involved in exorcisms. His stories are wild. I don't have a problem in believing in the supernatural or God. Robbie in Australia says this. I always want to say thanks for so many interesting topics and guests. I wanted to write in with a possible answer to the question about why God only performs miracles that occur naturally and doesn't, for example, cure amputees. I know I've written in several times, but this question seemed to be unanswered during the conversation. To me, it seems quite possible that God performs all miracles without ever changing the material universe. God, being timeless, would be aware of all prayers and all possible consequences of apparently miraculous events before the universe and time itself began. As a result, God would be able to set up the universe and all the physical and other governing laws so that highly improbable events occur at the times that fit in with God's design. God would have the ability to create the universe in such a way that there would not be a need to reach into reality and change it. Miracles, then, rather than being events that bend the laws of the universe, become events that are incredibly unlikely and therefore whose timing is what makes them a miracle. Even the ultimate miracle of Jesus' resurrection could be that Jesus was born with an incredibly unlikely genetic mutation that meant his body was unusually hardy and able to appear as dead after a crucifixion but subsequently recover over a period of a couple of days, which really isn't that far out of the realms of modern-day medical science. The miracle becomes that it happened to be the body of Jesus that was born with that genetic mutation at that point in time. I suggest all of this is one possible way of explaining why God only performs miracles that are consistent with the governing laws of the universe, rather than, for example, healing amputees. Philosophically, I believe the existence of this possible explanation doesn't mean that God couldn't or doesn't reach into the universe and change it. It's simply an example that I believe negates the apparent argument against God that documented miracles only appear to be consistent with the other known laws of the universe. Anyway, thanks for that suggestion. It's a very interesting one, Robbie. I'm not sure I know what you mean. But I feel that the whole point of Jesus's resurrection, especially Jesus's resurrection, is that it very much contravened the natural. You know, death is, if you like, the last enemy. And so I don't get the sense that what we're being told in the scriptural account of Jesus's resurrection is that someone with a very unusual genetic, you know, body sort of appeared dead, but then was able to revive again. I think what we're looking at there is something about death being rolled back, a natural process being miraculously overturned. So that's just my perspective on it, but I appreciate yours as well. Thanks for getting in touch. The Doubters Club, another show that had a very interesting conversation between my two guests, Preston and Gaia. This is Zeke, who says, as usual, my mind is humming with ideas after listening to the show. As usual, getting to those I didn't agree with is more fun. I'm always struck with how both believers and non-believers on your show miss a couple of foundational ideas that strike at the root of the issues. One is the purpose of church, and another is how the standards of this age get inadvertently smuggled into these conversations unchallenged. Westminster Question 1 reminds us of our own purpose, to glorify God and enjoy him forever, and therefore also points to the purpose of congregating in church. We're not primarily there for ourselves, but for the God we are worshipping. As I travel and visit churches, I see those both more liberal and more conservative falling victim to making church primarily about us. We sing the songs we like, talk about the topics we like, and associate with people we like. It's as if we must continually learn the Israelite lesson of the golden calf at Mount Horeb. Like them, we say to God, "We want to worship you, but if we make this golden calf, it'll make it much more accessible for us." Progressives, conservatives, and unbelievers alike want to tell God how we should worship him. In defining the importance of worshipping with love and truth at its core, Gaia wants church to be about community, acceptance, and not judging. She wants it to be about the Jesus of the Gospels. She then further defines love and justice in terms of the social mores of the day, LGBTQ, abortion, and the like. Conservatives can be just as guilty in defining terms like love and justice in terms of the conservative social issues of the day. So in my opinion, God does not need us to tell him how we should worship him. Worship consists of humbling ourselves and joining communally to lift up his holy name. We are worshipful beings. We will worship something, either ourselves or him. Thanks, Zeke. And maybe we've just got time for one more. Why don't we go to Jeff, going right back to the beginning of the year, the show with Dean and Dan, who joined me, Dan Patterson, author of a new book on Christianity, and Dean Mays, who's an intensive care unit nurse, who's sort of agnostic, but very much interested and in learning about Christianity. So Jeff said, "I really identified with Dean in this conversation, particularly in regard to his struggle to conceptualize God. Whereas he has come to this point through Jordan Peterson's work from a non-Christian background, I've come to a similar point from a Christian background and have in the process turfed out the conceptualization of God that was perhaps too naive or simplistic. While I nearly lost my faith in the process, Jordan Peterson's work helped me hold in tension the difficulty in conceptualizing God and my faith. What may be helpful to Dean and what I'm exploring at the moment is that as we, relational beings, having an intellectual understanding of how the Christian God best answers the questions is only a small part of the actual knowledge of God. It is the walking with God, the participation with God in the work of loving each other on earth through compassion, serving and restoring what is not right that completes our knowledge of who God is. I can't relate to an old grey bearded sage sitting in the clouds anymore, but it is still quite difficult to relate to an ideal, a logos, the way you'd relate to another person, but we have to bring God out of the abstract realm. Dean is already doing many good works, and it certainly sounds as though for the right motivations. And I pray Dean is blessed for his works with faith and ever more understanding. Thanks to Dean and Dan for having the conversation, for their works in their communities across the divide." Thank you very much, Jeff, and all those who've been in touch with thoughts about recent editions of the show. Good to be able to read some of those out that were still in my mailbag. You can get in touch with the show too, unbelievable@premier.org.uk. I read all the emails we get. I can't respond to all of them, and I can't read them all out on the show, but we get to as many as we can. If you'd like more from the show, do check out our show page, premierchristianradio.com/unbelievable. There's links there as well to our Unbelievable conference, Saturday the 14th of May. Yeah, you're going to hear me talk about this a lot in the next couple of months, because I want you to come. I want you to be there. It's going to be a great day, and it's a really important theme, God unmuted, taking God off mute. We live in a divided and often confused culture, and we've got some really wise voices that'll be helping to guide us through that on the day. So unbelievable.live is the place to go to book in, and you can find the links with today's show. For now, let me tell you what's coming up next week. Best-selling Christian author Philip Yancey recently sat down with me for an extended live Q&A with hundreds of Unbelievable listeners. Perhaps you were part of it. Well, if you were, you'll be able to listen again. And if you weren't, you'll be able to find out his thoughts on faith, doubt, the crisis in Ukraine, and the future of the US church. It's a show where he opens up about his own journey with God and the grace he's seen in his life. And Philip has some excellent new books out, Where the Light Fell, his memoir, and also A Companion in Crisis, which is his paraphrase of John Donne's spiritual works. So look out for that on next week's show. Until then, have a good week, and we'll see you next time.